Carmen, thanks for coming on today. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day and your busy schedule.
Thank you, Chris. I appreciate you as well. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this presentation. We've had it in the diary for a little bit of time now. Before we kind of get into the details, why don't you just give us a quick background and like rundown of who you are and kind of what you're doing at the moment?
Okay, thank you. Without droning on and on, I've been a strength and conditioning coach. I think now we call ourselves performance coaches, but anyway, I've been a strength and conditioning coach since 1998. So I've been in the game for quite a long time. I started in basketball, specifically in women's basketball, and was at the University of British Columbia. We won a few national titles when I was with that program. So that was an awesome start to my career. And through my 20s, I also worked with, being Canadian, quite a few professional hockey players, and as well as, you know, sort of junior developmental age athletes in ice hockey as well. And then after I sort of segued out of basketball and hockey, I started a business in graduate school really took on all kinds of different clients. So I had contracts with field hockey teams. I worked with tennis players, so lots of different athletes, and then some general population. And I also began my teaching career. So I've been a university and college level instructor since 2006. And I do that full time. So my coaching is a part time job, but the two go obviously hand in hand. And now my client roster includes mostly American football players, all positions, as well as national team, U.S. right now, U.S. national team freestyle wrestlers. So that's kind of where I'm at. But I do have some experience in professional MMA as well. I had a sort of a short stint in my career working with MMA athletes, which a lot of times people lump together with wrestlers. Apples and oranges, folks, not at all the same. Not the same person, not the same personalities, not the same really anything. The biggest difference between the two is the sport culture. So some of my wrestlers actually train with the football players. Like as training linemen in football and training grapplers or wrestlers is actually probably almost more similar than training MMA and wrestling.
Right.
Yeah. So that's a little bit about what I'm up to now.
Yeah. So it's quite a varied kind of background there, working with loads of different types of sports and personalities, I can imagine. And I know today we are going to get into some of the depths, maybe in the physiology side as well, to do with energy system development, which is something that I'm personally quite passionate about. Before we get into that though, can we just touch on testing? When you get an athlete in, kind of what's one of the first things that you look at? How do you decide what test you're going to do? And then within that as well, the difference between maybe more diagnostic testing versus sport specific testing. Is there a
great, yeah,
is there one
sure
that we should be doing, or I'll let you kind of take over?
Well, I think we're always limited as practitioners by what we have access to. So, you know, the people listening are probably going, "Ooh, testing, like I don't have a lab." You know, ironically, I don't use the lab much at the college I teach at because it's being occupied. It's a teaching lab. It's not a testing lab. So meaning it's always occupied, well, except right now, with instructors teaching. So I have brought in, I have a world medalist, two world medalists I'm currently working with in wrestling. And I have brought one of them in to be tested in front of my students. So that way they can compare like a student in the class, their data to a high level athlete. But let's circle back to your question about what it is that I'm testing and what kind of tests I'm selecting. When I worked for Wrestling Canada, I was with that program for almost 4 years. We were told what tests to run. So we did the Australian beep test. I think the first time I tested them, I did actually the yo-yo test. I'm just trying to think back. Maximal strength testing, vertical jump, broad jump, body composition, which is usually done at on site at our national training center, which is in Calgary, so not out west where I'm located. And so I would do those tests, but I was always sort of more curious beyond what I would consider to be maybe fitness tests. and versus like a performance test. So maybe we'll look at the beep test or the, you know, the shuttle test. And although you can extrapolate a maximal aerobic speed from the test and then write a running program based on that, it still doesn't give you any data around the athlete's threshold, their LT2 or maximal lactate steady state, whatever terminology you want to use. It's all the same, basically the same metabolic threshold. And wrestlers, I don't know if you guys have noticed, they're not the best long distance runners. So, you know, it became a bit of a baseline just fitness test for, say, the younger athletes. Like, you know, do you have a minimal standard? And when I analyzed all the literature in wrestling performance, we found that for females, their VO2 should be above 50. You know, at the world level, they're probably a little bit higher, like 53, 54, kind of in that category. So they have a pretty decent level of central endurance, if you will. But again, the VO2 also misses another big point, and that's the ability of the muscle itself to extract oxygen. And the only way we can place bets on that is doing like NIRS, which I don't have access to. But even NIRS doesn't have any normative data you can compare your athlete to. It's pre and post type testing. It's not like a vertical jump where there's a huge database where you can say your vertical jump is 38 inches, which we all know in not, you know, imperial terms, that's it's elite, right?
Yeah.
But if someone says your saturation rate is 83, everyone's like, what does that mean? So there's some problems with that as well. So I started doing a lot of my own testing within workouts, either doing what we call a lactate recovery test, which isn't actually on the presentation that you looked at, Chris. It's what we do is we do a maximal test. So let's say a wind gate. Just something that you know is going to make a huge shift in pH. You could also have the athlete run a 300-yard shuttle. And you want to assume they're going all out. 1 minute post-test, you take their blood lactate. Then do it again 5 minute post-test, which is usually going to be their peak, right? And then you have them actively recover. And this is important. So you have them jog or cycle on the bike with no resistance, just moving the legs. And I'm actually monitoring their heart rate as well during this time. And then we do it. The third data point is a 20 minute lactate. And that'll tell you how well the muscle can and the blood can recycle that energy source or that fuel source that is a byproduct of anaerobic glycolysis, right? So there's a more useful test in terms of telling us where there might be a deficit or a limitation. Is the limitation the heart and its pumping ability, or is the limitation the ability to extract the oxygen and then also work the muscle's ability to work more oxidatively, even in a recovery setting? I'm kind of going on and on, but other things I looked at was the ratio of back squat to power clean, because we do test both of those lifts to know whether or not the athlete, you know, is deficient in power or deficient in maximal strength. And of course, you know, just comparing the lifts to the norms. And then the third one was a reactive strength index test, which I think is extremely useful from a programming standpoint as well. And you can even go as far as programming the height of your depth jumps for the box height and things like that. So to me, to circle back to your question, to me, testing, if it doesn't give us at this level, if it doesn't give us something we can base a prescription on, or it doesn't uncover the limitation, what's limiting performance, it's not the best test, and it's maybe just a fitness test, right? Like a beep test is really a fitness test. It doesn't give us a ton of information that is useful for the population I work with.
For sure. And so is that something with kind of regards to the lactate testing, like five minutes or immediately post, essentially, or 1 minute post, 5 minutes post, and 20 minutes post?
Yeah.
Is that something you do with quite a lot of your athletes, or would like to do with a lot of your athletes, just because it does allow you to see the like kind of utilization or clearance, should I say, ability?
I've done it with the grappling. So I did it with an athlete who was in the, at the time was fighting in the UFC, and I did it with the wrestlers that are my top athletes. With my football players, I'm less concerned about this particular metric, if you will. I mean, it less concerned than other metrics, you know, than their pure, you know, speed and change direction ability and other qualities. So I could spend my whole life testing and, you know, that would be great, but I have to coach and develop certain things. And so another thing around testing for just for your viewers is, you know, if you give an athlete a protocol and you give them a certain load, meaning weight, say external load for that protocol. So say it's a 12 kilogram kettlebell for a particular protocol and they can't handle it, that's a test, right? And then 6 months later they can handle it, that's a test, right? You know, as long as you're monitoring your athletes and you're prescribing the doses, and I think I have a slide later on where I talk about how important and how detailed prescription needs to be. It has to be so detailed because it's like a study. Right? If your prescription isn't detailed, that's your methods. And then you can repeat it. And if you repeat it over time and you note improvement, you've just basically conducted a study. You've basically done pre and post testing. Mm-hmm. Right? So consider that part too. It doesn't always have to be the separate day. And I don't always have the luxury of time to spend 3 days just testing athletes. And trust me, athletes hate being tested. It's stressful. You know, the one thing I loved about working with Wrestling Canada was they would always give us a month window. We want your athletes to be tested at some point during this block of time, whatever works for you with where you're at. And a lot of the times I didn't have to do max strength testing because I always had an idea of where they were at in the weight room, you know, and then we would just build in the other tests at a time that worked. You know, so it wasn't detracting and taking away from their actual training stimulus.
You tried to just use that training as testing, testing as training.
Yeah, all the time. Kind of absolutely. Yeah. And it gives you a bigger, as you know, Chris, it gives you a bigger cross section of data because you could test somebody, they could be having a good day. You could test them and they could be having a bad day.
Sure.
You know, and I don't know always know what they've done at practice. I don't, and that's going to run interference, right? So testing is something that you're collecting data all the time and you're looking at it over a long period of time. You're not going to make all your decisions based on the one day or the one time that you tested somebody.
100%. Just moving on there. So we talked briefly just before we started recording here, just about the alactic aerobic approach to conditioning. So essentially, the way I look at it is working above and below the demands of the game. Do you mind kind of just getting into that approach? Why maybe the alactic outputs are really important, and the aerobic is obviously a very important aspect there to replenish those alactic stores. And then we'll get into kind of down the line here, kind of the glycolytic system as well.
Right. So, you know, I think the way I view training is it's always about extending capacity or a threshold of a pathway, of a metabolic pathway. So, but there's ceilings for every sport. So a marathoner is going to need a higher ceiling in aerobic capacity than a combat sport athlete will, just by the nature of their sport. And I look at it as what is highly trainable? And then what are the adaptations? Are the adaptations morphological, meaning are we actually making a structural change somewhere in the body? And if it is, that's going to take time and dedication. So aerobic development takes time and dedication. And if it doesn't start in younger years, and I'm not talking making kids do like triathlons and other weird adult crap, but, you know, making sure they're getting continuous play for the minimum, you know, amount of time every week, and building that engine, if you will, or those engines, building the ability to the stroke volume, building, you know, mitochondrial density in type 1 fiber when they're young, because those, even though those fibers aren't really helpful for speed power athletes directly, they do have a huge indirect role. So I'm big on building up that aerobic engine and spending time building that aerobic engine. And then the other, so that's sort of like the bottom or the foundation. But then there's the, like you said, the alactic piece too, where the nice thing about training that system is we can get, again, huge morphological change in muscle tissue by means of mitochondrial density without the cost of doing business or the interference effect of fatigue. So if you're working truly, I actually don't like the term alactic. I probably should have never typed that, but as a physiologist, it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's a coaching term because there's no such thing as being completely absent of lactate, but let's say it's a controllable outcome. It's controllable. Like you produce a bit of lactate when you do a, you know, an 8-second sprint, for sure you do. But because you've inserted these long recovery periods and you've been very specific about how you recover, which we can talk about later, the thought process is that that lactate can get shuttled, right? This is the shuttle hypothesis. It can move to slow twitch fiber. It can move to the heart. It can move to the brain. It can get resynthesized back into glycogen and be stored in the liver. It goes away, but it goes away somewhere good. And there's no fatigue residual, like training residuals that are from a metabolic standpoint that are going to run interference to another session that that athlete might do that day. Mm-hmm. So if they're going to go to sport practice, we do the speed work first, which is the quote unquote alactic work first. They take the time to recover. They could go, theoretically, they could possibly go straight into their sport practice and actually have a really, really good practice, high quality, not a lot of fatigue. But if we focus and we put all our eggs in the bucket of glycolysis, then we've got a huge window of EPOC, right, which is the amount of oxygen we're consuming after we're finished training. So the energy metabolizing the lactate, okay, and we're really actually dealing with a lot of hydrogen and a big pH shift, which is disruptive to homeostasis. We're also dealing with a massive body temperature shift. This is why it works to do these crazy, like, you know, shit king, pardon my language, circuits to people, why it works for weight loss. It's because you're using a ton of energy after, but for an athlete that actually is going to practice or work on their skills, now we've got fatigue competing, you know, with skill development. And we can't afford that. That's too costly. So my philosophy, I guess, to circle back to your question is, yeah, to bring up the buckets and make them as full as possible with alactic or speed capacity, mm-hmm, and endurance capacity. And then that middle stuff, that medium intensity work, we can do at certain times of the year to peak an athlete for competition, but there's no morphological adaptations associated with training that pathway. So it's not a long-term adaptation either. If you train it and then you take time off, you're going to detrain quite quickly.
Am I right in thinking most of those adaptations, quite a lot of them are like enzymatic adaptations, very short term, maybe two, maybe 3 weeks at best?
I don't know, actually. I haven't come across much research on the length of time, but I would guess, based on some of the detraining research, yeah, you know, 2-3 weeks. And yeah, you're 100% right that the adaptations are, you're just boosting up the enzymes. They're called rate limiting enzymes. So they speed up chemical reactions. So if we add some more salt to the recipe, which are more enzymes, the chemical reactions, then they're faster. The end result is still hydrogen. But the nice thing about that pathway is it can produce ATP at a faster rate than moving through the Krebs cycle and over to, like, oh God, all the boring stuff we learned in college, right? And stuff I have to teach. But you know what I mean? If we take the time, if the body has to do all that, it takes a long time. So it is useful to be trained in the glycolytic pathway. But the cool part about it is you don't have to do it all the time fit there.
Well, like you said earlier, the cost of doing business is so high working within that pathway as well.
Yeah, I mean, you get fatigued. So, you know, when people And there's, you know, people think it's intense. It's interesting. I read this one study that they did on athletes' RPE, so their perception of the load. And most athletes will tell you that if they did a sprint workout, let's say they're doing, yesterday my football players did 6 repetitions of circle run. So they do running around the circle on a soccer pitch. Mm-hmm. And the circle itself, one of my football players is a student in geography or geology, one of the two. Anyway, his physics knowledge is crazy. So he calculated the radius of the circle in about like 3 seconds, 60 wow. yards. So average time around the circle was about 8 seconds. So it's a pretty long sprint, right? So we did 6 of those and we took 3 to 4 minutes of rest in between each one. I was just monitoring, I timed every rep. So I was just monitoring like to see if they were getting slower, staying on track. And it also tells me a lot back to testing, a lot of their fitness. So I had one guy on his third rep could got faster. He ran a 7.88. On his first one, he ran an 8.03, an 8, and then 7.88. And I said, okay, we have a new nickname for you. And he goes, what's that? I said, the heat. And I said, you need to be warm to perform, right? But had I, you know, where some of my other athletes with more body fat started to decline their performance on this particular protocol. What was my question you asked me, Chris? I'm now on a tangent and I've forgotten the question.
I've actually forgotten about. Did
you forget?
Yeah, I mean, I was just enjoying where you were going with that.
Yeah, I guess. Okay, RPE. Sorry, everybody. So RPE. So if I ask these kids, which I did, like, and we did this at the end of the training session. So we'd been training for an hour, 15 minutes up to this point. And I said, you know, how hard is this? It's not like, they're like, oh, this is fine. You know, they're a bit sore the next day, but it's not bad. But if I, let's say I made them run the 300-yard shuttle test. So that's like a minute long, a minute of maximal running. And let's say I had them only do it once. They'd all have to give me an RPE of 10. I already know that. And even though the intensity is actually lower because the velocity is slower, it's more intense perceived by the athlete simply because of the pH change. So we do have to be mindful of that of coaches. As sports scientists, we're all like, oh, well, that's medium intensity work. Yes, when we look at it, when we're prescribing exercise, but how it's perceived, trust me, the fastest way to do completely destroy, you know, your pH is to do 1 minute of maximal work. That's like the best protocol to just, if you want to kill someone, do that, right? If you want them to perceive it as being really hard, even though we wouldn't rate it as really hard or really intense work. So that was kind of my point. We have to take their perception into account too. And there's an educational piece around that. Sometimes athletes, like wrestlers especially, are used to really, really, I don't want to use the word intense, just painful training sessions, that when you give them something that's not as painful, not going to use the word intense, they say it's easy.
Right.
And they're resting too long, but yet they're getting better. It's a harder sell. For a football player, it's an easy sell because the average play in a football game is 6 to 7 seconds.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I feel like I actually come across that issue with, well, coaches, number one, and then like tennis players, and like a lot of the athletes that I work with, just because they're used to, obviously, their conditioning for the vast majority of the time is revolved around high intensity, like repeat sprint training or whatever it's going to be, that obviously
you with minimal rest, right?
Exactly. Like, you end up in this pool of lactate that where it's kind of that middle zone and it just sucks, but there's not really those long-term adaptations that you talked about kind of happening there.
No, and that's because the coaches are not qualified. Mm-hmm. Right?
100%.
They know the sport. How could you know your sport, the sport at a high level in and out, and understand that sport science at the same time? It's too much to know. So, you know, it's important that coaches sort of collaborate and work with strength and conditioning coaches that have this level of knowledge. But I would even argue that a lot of strength and conditioning coaches could brush up in this area, right? To understand it a little bit better.
For sure. Mm-hmm. For sure. Just moving like back a step, actually, you talked about the guys running around the center circle in the football field. And you said they were working for 8 seconds, resting for 3 to 4 minutes. So obviously huge amounts of high quality work going on there. Just touching on for, like, for me as well, but for some of the listeners that maybe don't know what the benefits to that are, like maybe some of the, like the alactic enzyme adaptations that you're looking for as a result of, we don't need to go too far down the rabbit hole.
Sure. Yeah. I mean,
maybe don't understand why you would rest for that long.
Yes. Okay. So we know that first of all, high intensity work. So this is high intensity, meaning high velocity, they're maximally sprinting, is going to shift the pH to a more acidic level. That's, and if we don't insert the rest, then it becomes a hindrance to performance. So we know that they're getting more acidic as the set goes on. Now we also know that in the ATP-CP pathway, metabolic pathway, the power of that pathway is around 6 seconds, but the capacity could be a little bit longer. So my goal right now, by doing the longer repetitions, is to build a little bit more endurance in that pathway, or what we call capacity. So that's why I'm working these athletes, and it depends on the athlete, but it's between 8 to 9 seconds. Now, my linemen, just so everybody knows, are not doing the full volume that the skills players are. They're doing 50% of the volume, so 50% of the circle. So that takes them closer to 5 seconds to run 50% of the circle. And if you can, I mean, these are guys that were well over 300 pounds, 325 pound athletes. Okay. So we have to be aware of kind of the stresses, you know, on them. But, you know, the adaptations happen because of a few things. One, like you said, Chris, long rest periods, which adds oxygen back to the equation. If we just call it a chemical equation or a recipe, that, and when we add the oxygen back in, we can resynthesize the phosphocreatine, which is a stored fuel source that's needed to power that type of work. And a lot of the literature on phosphocreatine resynthesis does go by time. They'll say you want to rest for, some people say, I think it was Charlie Francis said something like 1 minute every 10 yards. Mm-hmm. That's very general. You need to monitor performance, okay? I find that it becomes less relevant the longer they run, the longer the distance is. So 60 yard sprints, then it might not be as relevant. Plus these athletes are running in a circle. It's actually not as fast as running in a straight line. And they also went at it from a running start, not a 3-point start. So there are other things that are impacting and creating potential fatigue. You just need to just know that different, like if you start from a static start, that's going to be more fatiguing than a jogging or a running start, or what we call a flying start. But back to phosphocreatine resynthesis, we also know that relaxation exercises help to resynthesize it faster. So when they are finished their lap, they shake their arms and legs as if they're shaking the meat off the bones, and they do 2 recovery breaths that sound like this. So really heavy, sharp breath out, blowing off some of the excess CO2. And then they just resume normal breathing. They try to consciously slow their breathing, but I'm not encouraging them to necessarily take like really deep breaths or anything like that. Just calming their nervous system down, shaking the meat off the bones. And after a couple of minutes, then they can talk amongst each other and continue to, and I just have them kind of walk around. They're not allowed to sit for a couple of reasons. One, I'm old school. To me, that looks lazy. You sit down, that's not cool. 2, it's because we don't want any stiffening of the muscle tissue. We want the muscle to stay very relaxed, and it does facilitate oxygen transport, and it does facilitate blood flow. So that's the recovery piece. The other part about training this system, so the sort of anywhere between say 6 and 10 seconds of work, is the ballistic nature of the work. So this wouldn't work if you were pushing a sled, a heavy sled. Okay. If you want to develop strength, push a heavy sled. If you want to improve the capacity of your short-term energy system and build more mitochondria, the movement that you choose or the modality of work must be ballistic. So there has to be kind of like a flight phase. And honestly, sprinting, there doesn't get anything much more superior than sprinting. And sprinting is also whole body. Now with wrestlers, I also use protocols with battling ropes because they need just as much endurance in their upper body as their lower body. Even though sprinting does build some in the upper body, it's still predominantly a lower body development, if you will. Mm-hmm. So I might choose a different modality using battle ropes with the upper body. But again, you know, if anyone's ever used battling ropes, like try doing like double waves for an entire minute. It's almost impossible. Like you look like you're going to die by about 30 seconds, no matter how fit you are. Right. And usually the fitter and more powerful you are, you will actually look worse. Okay. So that's why you do these timed short, quick, ballistic, sharp, really high intensity intervals to really exploit that system. And then you recover with relaxation drills to allow the oxygen system to kind of come in, sweep in, and resynthesize the phosphocreatine. So that's really kind of the Cole's notes of the adaptations that occur. And if you don't do that, if you do like equal work to rest, then you're going to bathe tissue with lactate. And eventually the pH shift, will be so drastic that you will create... Actually, I'll tell you something interesting, Chris, and for your readers, you this is not in the presentation that you reviewed, but it has to do with hypertrophy. And so I went to a lecture about 3 years ago in Portland, Oregon, and the speaker is a mentor of mine and a friend. His name is Pavel Tatsulin. He's Russian, and people know him for kettlebells, but he's much more than just kettlebells. He's very well-trained practitioner and thinker. And we were talking about hypertrophy and the mechanisms of hypertrophy. And you know how in university we all learn that lactate doesn't cause muscle soreness? Doesn't. We learn, no, it doesn't. It's a metabolic byproduct. It does not cause muscle soreness. Well, apparently that may not be true. And this is the thought process. The thought process is lactate is the byproduct of anaerobic glycolysis. So lactate is a surrogate marker that we use to monitor pH change without directly monitoring hydrogen ion concentration. But it is the hydrogen ions that do not get accepted and taken over to the electron transport chain that wreak havoc in the muscle cell. So when we have a massive shift in pH in the muscle cell, and we do this chronically, what they think might happen is that it actually eats away or rips away the sarcolemma, which is the casing of the muscle fiber, and causes damage, like actual damage to the wall. And that the reason why people have hypertrophy as a side effect with metabolic training is because the muscle cell itself has had to reinforce itself bigger and thicker in order to deal with these awful changes in pH. So in a way, if we think about hypertrophy, and let's imagine the person's not really lifting weights, but they're doing a lot of like heavy metabolic work, heavy glycolytic work, maybe that hypertrophic adaptation is in fact not an adaptation that is good. It's maladaptation. It's maladaptive. Because you've added insult to the tissue and the tissue has no choice but to help itself. So I thought, I mean, I've kind of like taken it a bit further with that. That's what went through my mind when I was listening to this lecture. But that's why, you know, you can possibly get muscle hypertrophy from doing isometrics if you hold the isometrics for long periods of time because of the hypoxic condition and the shift in pH in the tissue.
Right. Well, that's fascinating.
So it's, you know, if you look at the common, Pavel kind of boiled it down. And he said, if you look at the common denominator in all bodybuilders' programs, what is it? He's like volume and short rest periods.
Yeah.
Period. And what's the recipe for hydrogen ion increase? Volume and short rest periods.
Mm-hmm. Well, it comes back to blood flow restriction training as well, essentially, at the end of the day.
Yeah.
In a hypoxic environment kind of makes sense.
Yeah, exactly. But then we wonder like which fibers are getting damaged. We do know that bodybuilders have an overdevelopment in type 1 fiber. Mm-hmm. And as a strength power coach, I don't care about that.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put a football team on a hypertrophy phase of doing sets of 15 reps or 10 to 15 on like a back squat. That just isn't the way that I operate because speed kills And so does endurance, to be honest. Size, I think if you're faster than your opponent, who cares? I mean, I played flag football for 10 years, and I remember coming up against this one girl that was, like, taller, bigger than me. And even though flag is, you know, not actual, like, not contact collision, there's still contact, you know. I was just always concerned about getting that, you know what, away from her, running as fast as I possibly could over and over, right? So
for sure. And I think if you're from, like, you mentioned football there, kind of hitting, I don't know, the classic thing that we're obviously taught in your university doing your degree program is muscular hypertrophy, 3x8 to 12 reps, like this sort of stuff. But like you say, it's more to do with the total volume, the total stress, the
intensity. Yeah, and the amount of volume needed is quite high in 3 sets. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Look at the bodybuilder's program. Even my shoulders are pretty big, but that's because of the amount of long cycle I do with kettlebells. Just the constant push pressing. In one workout, I might do 300 repetitions.
Wow. Yeah, that's some serious volume.
But of submaximal work, right? It's not high intensity work. It's submaximal. It's probably 50% of my shoulder press max, right?
Mm-hmm. So then, but then if we look at stay with the theme of hypertrophy, if we take more of a clustered approach to hypertrophy, that's obviously going to have, like, more benefits because we can maybe lift more weight. We're going to switch up the rest periods there as well. How's that going to work kind of metabolically compared to things like if we do the jump squat protocol? I think, is it Verkhoshansky's jump squat protocol with 30% of the one RM back squat, things like that?
Right. Yeah, I think because the time under tension in some of the ballistic stuff, like jumping, that's why you quite possibly don't incur the same hypertrophic response as you would using, like, a free weight, right? Even if you were clustering it. I don't know if I've maybe misread your question, Chris, but I don't, what do you mean by cluster training? Just so I'm on the same page.
We break our set of six up into twos. So we might do we'll unrack the bar. We'll do two.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Bar again. Do you know what I mean? Then we'll take 30 seconds after every two reps and we'll break it into, instead of it being 3 sets of 6, we'll kind of break it up into more sets.
If that makes sense. So you do that for the purpose of what?
So just trying to increase the quality of each rep. So we're driving more intent. We can lift heavier loads, potentially.
So getting speed, more right? Power.
Yeah.
But I would say no, you wouldn't get, I do that, but for the purposes of avoiding hypertrophy.
Okay, that's interesting.
And increasing relaxation speed of the tissue. Right. That's actually, that comes from Verkhoshansky too in his special strength training manual. Uh-huh. I'm trying to think of when the last time I presented on that material. It was recently, it was in Australia at their conference in November at their national conference. I talked a little bit about when I back squat my athletes a lot of times of the year with those singles. It's one rep, shake the legs, one rep, shake the legs. So yeah, they do 4 reps or 3 reps at 88%. So pretty heavy. But we do work on facilitating relaxation speed because that is the cost of doing hypertrophy business. I am very anti-hypertrophy. Pure and simple, like the purest. The only time I might do it is with a young developing athlete that's 18 or 19 years old for a period of time when I am willing to sacrifice other qualities, you know, for that. And I think guys and girls that have a lot of muscle mass, I mean, if you look at my programming and then you looked at my clients, you would be shocked at their volume. And it's genetics. Like, they all have freaky good genetics for size, period.
So what would you know, just on that kind of point then, if you've got, I don't know too much about wrestling, so correct me kind of as I go along here.
That's okay. I don't either.
But if you're working with a male or female athlete that maybe has to reach a certain weight class, how would your hypertrophy program maybe look there? So say they maybe needed to gain like a few kilograms.
If they want, if they had to put on weight.
Yeah, to make sure they made it into like a certain weight class.
I probably would add a little bit more volume to their training program. Time under tension is big. So again, if you're back squatting or front squatting, you're moving, you know, a control down power up. I'm always power up, like speed on the way up. Mm-hmm. But I might have them doing, you know, sets of five or six. I had a guy that played for the Saskatchewan Roughriders, a CFL football player. He was a defensive end in university. I trained him throughout his high school. And then when he went off to university, he worked with their program. And when he turned pro, he came back to see me. And he was 239 pounds at a 4.6 940. Okay, so very athletic gentleman. After his first season in the CFL, he, that first off season, I had a bit of rehab to do with him. But after we kind of got through that, we used actually sets of fives and sixes on his squats. And we never did more than six reps ever in the off season. But my total volume load never went above 30. So that's five sets of six. Mm-hmm. And he was 250 pounds when he went to camp. And so I have these guys usually from January to May. So whatever, that's 4 months, 4 or 5 months to put 11 pounds of lean mass on him. And the ticket to that wasn't, I mean, might've been some of it, might've been the strength training, but a lot of it was the diet, the food intake, right? The calories. So, and I don't, with the wrestlers, I don't handle that at all because we have dietitians that work with our national teams. With my pros, I might jump in and help a bit or use some of the consultants. I have a really good nutrition consultant that works with USA Boxing and the Golden State Warriors. She's phenomenal. So she'll advise if I need her to for, like you say, like with the weight gain, but I very rarely like would put a wrestler on what I would consider like a hypertrophy plan, because I think there's just too much sacrifice of performance. It's got to be about what they're eating and eating enough.
Yeah,
you know, and that's my philosophy. And you know, I'm really, really big on athletes being fit. And I know that there was a guy I worked with years ago that had this sort of knowledge, and I'm not familiar with it. It's something called functional hypertrophy. Have you heard of that?
I've heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah. It was put together by a PhD who's kind of more of a bodybuilder. And I looked, and this guy I worked with wanted to do a German volume phase with athletes. Have you heard of that?
Yeah.
So it's like a 10 by 10.
Yeah. That sucks.
Well, I just was like, why? You know, like, and these are athletes that have to go to practice and have to run and do other things. Like, I think that stuff is fine if it lives in the world of a bodybuilder. But, you know, if we're borrowing our methodology from someone that doesn't actually perform, what are we doing?
Yeah, 100%. I think the big thing is with that, if we look at, right, from my point of view, if we look at the German volume training, it's taken away from performance more than we're actually putting in, which is the big issue.
100%. Like, let's make dudes really sore and really slow, like for the sake thereof, right? For the sake of putting on 5 pounds. You know what? Some guys will do that, not gain any muscle, right? Because of their genetics, right? It's just not in the cards. Like, for their, I have a 9-year-old son, he's almost 10. And I can already see that he will have really big muscular legs if he wants to. Mm-hmm. Like, it's genetic. He got, unfortunately, inherited that from me. So, you know, well, he will. Yeah. I think for a girl, it maybe not so much as like, oh, mom, thanks a lot. Right. But for a boy, yeah. Right. But it's totally genetic, you know, not 100%, but like, in order to go that far against your genetic potential and do all these things that create so much residual fatigue, so much soreness, it just doesn't seem like the path of least resistance. And it doesn't seem very fun.
Yeah.
And shouldn't training at the end of the day for athletes be kind of fun? Like, a lot of the protocols I develop, I switch in and out every phase because there's so many different ways to train this quality of alactic speed endurance. Uh-huh. So like we'll run hills for a couple months in the summer because it's nice outside. And then in winter when the weather gets bad, let's get you doing the jump squat protocol. Because they're all general at the end of the day, right? Chris, like, all this stuff is not wrestling. This is general training, but with a specific adaptation, cellular adaptation.
For sure. We're kind of running on time a little bit now, and I don't want to take too much of your time.
That's okay. I'm chatting.
Can we just get into, just for some of the listeners, we talk about kind of the glycolytic system. We've talked quite a bit actually about lactate. And lactic acid. Do you mind just delving into and do a little bit of a myth bust for me here? Behind kind of, is lactic acid the bad guy? Is there a difference between lactate and lactic acids? And just kind of go into a few of those details there for maybe some listeners that aren't fully sure on that topic.
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, it's confusing. And I remember being in university, taking this stuff for the first time going, what the heck is this guy talking about in the front of the room? Then you read the textbook and you read the paragraph 70 times and you still don't know what the hell you've just read. So when I finished grad school and I started teaching exercise physiology, I said to my husband, I don't want to teach this. This is too hard. This is too hard to explain. I mean, it's one thing to read it and regurgitate it on a test, but then to explain it to people. And he said, he's always been, you know, kind of my cheerleader. And he's like, you know, you just got to study. You just got to read more. You got to master this. I'm like, all right. So
I've got to tell you this. It's just reminded me.
I
lectured in strength and conditioning at the University of Bath in the UK before I moved to the States. And I was doing the physiology lecture. Kind of, we were talking about just, what was it? We're talking cross-bridge attachments and blah, 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 blah. And I look up and there's a girl on the front row and she's just straight Zeds, just asleep on the front row. I'm like, brilliant.
Awesome.
I've got to change this. I've got to do something different. But like you say, you've got to kind of make it interesting.
Totally. Or applied, right? Yeah. So it's hard to apply something you can't imagine. You know, people talk about everyone has a different learn style. Bullshit. No, we don't. That's been refuted. The VARC learning styles have been refuted. This is how people learn, through association, period. So if something is coming at you out of left field, you've never seen it before, you can't associate it with anything you already know, it's going to be very foreign and very hard to understand. So, I mean, the best way to learn about metabolism and energy system is to exercise and experience different work to rest ratios, you know, to get a feeling. But let's walk people through this pathway. So essentially, if someone's doing work that lasts, you know, more than 20 seconds up to 2 minutes, and they're going as hard as they can for that length of time, we consider that to be kind of near maximal intensity. So if you want to imagine you're on the bike and you're going to go 30 seconds, as hard as you can for 30 seconds, over that 30 seconds, you will start to experience usually, you know, a burn in the muscle. And it doesn't always correlate with heart rate. So putting a heart rate monitor on to train the system doesn't make much sense because the heart will respond kind of after the interval's over. So you feel this burn and you're wondering, well, what's going on? Well, essentially, there's 10 steps in this pathway. And the pathway starts with sugar. It starts with either glycogen or glucose, which is carbs. So let's just say carbs. We start with carbs. We can't use anything else. Carbs get broken down. And as they get broken down, hydrogen ions start to get produced. This is what I tell my students. I said, okay, hydrogen ions are like bratty children with no chaperone. They are loose. They are run havoc in the school. They're destroying shit. They're spray painting lockers. I don't know, but they're a pain in the ass. But then there's a couple of chaperones. One's named NAD and the other one is named FAD. And what they do, if the conditions in the muscle cell are such that NAD and FAD can handle the children, there's not too many children, they pick them up and they carry them over to the Krebs cycle. Okay? And then they get oxidized. Awesome. But if the demands of the muscle cell are super high or your fitness is super low, okay, so you don't have good fitness, you have a low lactate threshold, you have a low anaerobic threshold, we could even call it, Then the hydrogen's like weeds. They start growing out of control, growing out of control, growing over out of control, and they can't get accepted by the chaperones. Maybe only a few get accepted, but most of them end up starting to alter the pH in the tissue. Now, lactic acid is the metabolic byproduct that's created from this system. When the end of the pathway, the 10 steps, we start with carbs, we end up with something called pyruvate. And pyruvate can either become lactate, all right, which can then get shuttled through different shuttles around the body, or we end up taking it over to the Krebs cycle, where the chaperones also took the children to the Krebs cycle, and things get moved around over there aerobically. But if the intensity is high and your fitness is low, so two things kind of have to happen, then lactate becomes what's produced. So, you know, the hydrogen ions is a way to deem sort of how acidic the conditions got, how much hydrogen is there. I don't use the term lactic acid much when I lecture, because the lactic acid, it quickly becomes lactate anyway. So I just use the end result, the end product, to keep it really simple. The end product is lactate from this pathway if the demands are high. Now, one thing that's really important for students and people listening to understand is that all pathways are on all the time. So we can have other pathways on in the background producing energy for us. And using different substrates, and even during the recovery intervals, other pathways can take over. But if we were to look at, you know, one pathway, that's sort of how I would explain it. And the lactate, it can basically hang out in the muscle cell. It can be moved from fast fiber to slow fiber. It can be moved to other areas of the body. So sometimes I'll have an athlete sprint up a hill and do push-ups at the top. Okay, that's a good way to shut it. Yeah, you can shut the lactate to the upper body.
So when training that system, then that means it's not a. Because that was good. That was actually one of my questions. If we got into kind of the protocols that you can use, it's not a full body effect. Do we need to do kind of, if we're going to try and create buffering capacity in the upper body, we obviously need to train the upper body. Training the lower body is not going to buffer the upper body.
I don't know about that. I think that buffering capacity can improve, but you have to consider the time factor. So let's say that you did expose the lower body, like you did all your intervals on a bike, all your glycolytic intervals on a bike, and you ended up producing more buffering agents. So sodium bicarbonate is a buffering agent, which is an adaptation. I would argue that you, in order for you to move it to be used to the upper body, that's going to just take time. So the more specific, that's the sport specific, I guess, training piece, is if the sport demands like whole body, you might want to make sure that you do some upper body glycolytic work as well, so that way you don't have to worry about moving these agents around. They can hang out. They can, you know, it's just like glycogen only gets depleted in the muscles that you're using, right? Yeah. So same kind of thought process. Yeah. So that's kind of how I explain it, it's the hydrogen that causes the pH change. So they need to be picked up.
For sure. I like that. Nad and Fad, just pick the kids.
Nad and Fad. Yeah. That's aunt and uncle. They take the kids over to the Krebs cycle, but you know, there's too many kids for them to handle. Then it's chaos and there's a pH change. That's the consequence. But then we insert recovery. So let's say you did 30 seconds on the bike as hard as you can. I gave this exact protocol to an athlete, four repeats, 30 seconds on, 4 minutes off, okay, with aerobic recovery. So then we can deal with all the hydrogen then during the recovery period. So if we can't deal with it during the work, we can deal with it during recovery. If we don't allow recovery, then we end up with buildup. Mm-hmm. They accumulate. Yeah. So I got in trouble from a wrestling coach for prescribing that. He said it was too easy of a workout.
Oh, wow. That's the thing. But if you go maximal intensity, that's a similar protocol to what I use with some of my guys, actually. If you go maximal intensity, like, that sucks. Like, you're emptying the tank.
Absolutely.
For 30 seconds. You're fully recovering. Yeah. And then do you mind just touching on some of those? I think we've covered this a little bit, but we're looking at a lot of kind of the upregulation there of the system as well, and the enzymatic, again, adaptations for the kind of lactic power or glycolytic power. Do you mind just touching on one or two of those adaptations?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's a ton of research that I've come across in the last couple of years, as it's been a while since I visited this topic. So I probably can't speak to the most recent articles that maybe are produced. You might even have more knowledge than I do in that area, Chris. But from what I understand is that because the adaptations are not structural or morphological, so we're not building more mitochondria, we're not building more capillaries around muscle tissue to deliver oxygen, we're not building more blood vessels even through the arterial system, the, you know, arterioles, we're really just adding more enzymes to the recipe. It's you know, boosting them up, if you will, that all we're doing is basically speeding up the reaction. And that if we don't kind of, but if we do that, because there's this huge change in the pH, then what happens is we can't really develop the other areas as well. Speed gets, there's a cost to speed, so speed cannot be maximized and endurance cannot be maximized. So a lot of times coaches will choose to only train this pathway because they want to teach the athlete to tolerate unfavorable conditions. I would argue that although that is true, why not create an engine so big that you don't encounter them, the unfavorable conditions?
Yeah.
No, right? So what they did in Russia, which is, I only found one article when I was doing my, writing my Wrestler's Edge book on testing, they actually did blood lactate analysis on world champions at the end of their match. And they had lower blood lactate at the end of the match compared to less trained or not world champions. How many athletes they tested, it was probably not enough. And of course, how the match goes, I mean, there's a lot of things that, I mean, I would criticize the research just like anybody, but it's interesting to think that a more highly trained athlete may not produce as much lactate. So like you could probably do a Wingate type test, which is not necessarily the best test for an acyclical athlete, but it is a good test in terms of dosing someone with a maximal effort, or do a 300-yard shuttle test or something like that. You know, you could get some interesting blood lactate readings and then look at their power. And if their power is really high and their lactate at 5-minute mark is pretty low, and then their ability to clear it is really fast, you probably have a very well-conditioned athlete.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's, like you said, that the best athletes essentially produce the least lactate. They can produce more power for longer, recover quicker.
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to threshold, right? So it was really, the argument was really never about energy systems and pathways. It was about raising the metabolic threshold of the athletes you're working with. But the challenge with that, with non-acyclic athletes, is that threshold is specific to modality. Mm-hmm. So my threshold running is different than my threshold doing long cycle with kettlebells, which is different than my threshold on a bike, but none of those things look like wrestling or rugby.
Yeah.
You know, so we have to keep in mind that this stuff is pretty general.
For sure. Just kind of just on that, just to close it out here. We've mentioned kind of lactate and training the glycolytic system. I've heard you before talk about using kind of lactate to almost peak your athletes. Now, not to be mistaken with using training that system as the peaking method, but just before you kind of maybe go into a little peaking block or a deload period, so to speak. Do you mind just explaining how you do that and what protocols you use?
Well, that's a great question because I've never done it myself. Okay. But I think I may have to do it now because of the COVID situation. So what I mean by that is that I rely on the coaches to do that.
Okay.
So typically like a wrestling match is 3 minutes on, 30 second break with some stalling. The athletes always stall. It's actually, it's part of their tactics. It's pretty brilliant. And then 3 minutes on again. That's a maximal length of a match if there isn't a pin, right? Mm-hmm. Or what they call a fall. So, you know, if you think about 3 minutes of like static dynamic work and then only a 30 second break and then another 3 minutes, like that's a pretty heavy glycolytic dose, right? You know, so what we do is in practices, the kids would twice a week spar for a period of 3 weeks prior to a major competition. And they would spar people that were challenging, that were, a lot of the girls will spar boys, young boys. Cause my, you know, a 17-year-old male would be a more on par with my 5-year-old female clients, mm-hmm. And also challenge them from a reactive ability and speed ability. They tend to be faster than the girls. So it's really good training stress. And so the coaches are the ones that actually do a really good job of that. The problem is that the coaches sometimes want to do this all year round, because they don't know what you know or what I know. It's not because of any malicious intent. It's what they've always done. And wrestling has always been a culture of the strongest will survive. Now, don't get me wrong. There are quite a few coaches now in our modern society that are typically a little younger that are really open to all the sports science, and they want to do it properly. And they bought my book and they're looking through it. And so I always give the coaches green light for practice to bring up this metabolic pathway to train those enzymes and do it in a sport specific manner with the right movements in the sport. So I don't ever do it myself. I always work aerobic alactic. Now, right now with COVID, I've been building it in to my athletes' workouts, because I'm also studying to do mental performance. So I'm going back to school. And so when I do, and I switch my brain to that side, and I think about the psychology of sport and the psychology of these athletes, is that a lot of them are feeling something is missing from their training. And they, no matter how much you convince them with science, the way that they feel is valid, right? And they feel like they're not working hard enough. So for example, I give one stimulus for an athlete where we would normally run up the side of a mountain, and it takes about 3 minutes to get to the top. And that's what we would classify as sort of like aerobic power development. Mm-hmm. And then you walk back down. So it's about a 4 minute break on the way down. So 3 minutes up, 4 minutes down times 4 repeats, I think, is where she's at now. What I've done is I've changed it a bit where she jogs a bit, sprints, and then jogs and sprints and jogs for that 3 minute dose. So she starts to get that feeling of actual, like the stress of wrestling, where you have to continue to keep moving and keep your posture, keep your mechanics while you have a heart rate over 90% max. So, and then for her next phase, we're going to build in some, I don't know what I'm going to call them, maybe glycolytic capacity circuits, right, where there'll be like loaded carries and things like you would see in a more of a fitness class, right? Which we all kind of like cringe at least I do, go, oh my God, like look at the vomiting cat posture as a person flips the tire, right? They're like, whoa, right? So it's pretty. But I mean, with good technique, with good mechanics, we'll start to intelligently build in 3 week blocks of this stuff as if we're peaking these athletes for a comp, because we can't, I don't believe, and I don't know the answer to this, but I can't imagine taking March, April, May, June, July, August, let's say 6 months completely off of glycolytic work. I can't, for a grappler, I can't imagine doing that. I don't think that that's, because if we think about what's the side effect of doing heavy glycolytic work, do you know? The physical feeling, how do you feel if you haven't done it in a while?
When you start going again?
Yeah. What's the symptom?
Fatigue.
You feel awful. Sometimes you vomit, right? When athletes vomit, they get a headache. Like it's, yeah. So exactly why athletes vomit, I mean, maybe it's a blood shunting thing, I'm not sure, but I don't want that to happen either. Yeah. Right. We can talk about like all these ideas of return to play and making sure tendons are strong and, you know, athletes don't pull their hamstrings. That's what everybody likes to talk about because they need to sprint. Well, I think too, they need some exposure to some of the actual sport specific and wrestling, because you're actually touching your opponent. These athletes cannot wrestle right now.
Yeah.
So we have to come up with, different devices. So I'm actually heading out today to buy a 100-pound heavy bag.
right?
Like a training dummy. Yeah, so we can start doing some, like, you know, carries with it, right? Yeah. Carry, flip, throw, different movements with this, with this load. For, you know, we'll probably start with 1 minute on, 1 minute off kind of thing, and then start to work towards an actual wrestling specific. Pretty aggressive. We'll do a pretty aggressive build. I think I'll probably do a lead-in week, and then we'll start to hammer it right away. But I haven't quite mapped that all out yet.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it makes sense as well. Yeah. If you think about the contact and kind of return to contact for rugby players as well, like things sure. like hitting a tackle pad, hitting a tackle shield repeatedly, just getting them used to those worst-case scenario almost conditions as well. And to be honest, a lot of the time it's not even worst-case scenario conditions that they see in a game. It's more the worst-case scenarios they see in practice.
True. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good point.
That's from my experience anyway. It's usually the worst-case scenario time is massively extrapolated in practice compared to ball in play during a rugby.
Absolutely. Yeah, I agree. And I think another thing for rugby wrestling is the vestibular training too. So making sure athletes are doing somersaults. So we're doing, you know, somersault into a sprint. Mm-hmm. So that way they're getting that inner ear development, cartwheels, backflips. All my wrestlers can do roundhouses and cartwheels and all kinds of gymnastics type movement. It's part of their warm up. So I just have them continue to do that as their warm up, maybe even before a conditioning session.
Uh-huh. Just build the right first.
Yeah, just to continue to develop the inner ear. Like anytime I had an athlete tear her hamstring at the 2016 Olympics, a wrestler, yeah. And it was devastating. And as part of her rehab, early on, I was like, okay, we're going to do this somersault, like backward forward roll routine. And she's like, what? Why? And I explained to her, because you're going to detrain all of the, you know, all of your inner ear. She's like, that makes complete sense. So she bought in, you know, and so as far as like the detraining of the glycolytic pathway, like 6 months is too long to not do any of it.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't even know if that's purely physiology, Chris, like let's expose these kids to like really unpredictable. And what I plan to do too, is I plan to set up a circuit and tell her what to do. Okay, go do this, go do that. So everything's unpredictable. Nothing is predictable. It's like a wrestling match. Because if you think about the economy of movement in things that we're good at and that's predictable, we immediately conserve energy. That's why, you know, aerobics instructors always have high body fat, right? It's predictable. They know what to do. Their brain knows how to do every movement. They conserve. In sport, no matter how much we off the pitch or off the field, we are not preparing our metabolic systems necessarily appropriately for the unpredictable nature of the sport when you have an opponent, when you share space with your opponent. So yeah, it'll be, I want you to run over there, pick that bag up. I want you to run with it I want you to jump over the cone 5 times. Then you're going to pick up this kettlebell in the rack. You're going to squat it for 10. And I'm just going to tell her what to do with my stopwatch on. And then I'll put a heart monitor on and I'll monitor things like RPE and make sure that and then I'll work with her. The thing with the kids I'm training, a lot of them are older and they're very collaborative on their development. So she'll tell me, yeah, need more of this, less of that to make it like wrestling. Yeah. So this is the only time I'm going to see my disclaimer, Chris, the only time that I'm going to be doing sport specific training. Right. Sounds right. Like,
it's essentially sounds like controlled chaos, but no, I like
it. Absolutely. But I, you know, we still need, like, what are our jobs? Our jobs are physical performance. And if they can't do their sport, which we've relied on now for so long and we've complained for so long that coaches aren't doing it right.
This is our chance.
We're all complaining about that, you know, but, you know, at the same time, now we have to do the job of the coach maybe. And now it's hard.
Yeah.
Now we have to be creative. Now we have to actually go outside of our little perfect world of alactic aerobic.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And I think sometimes we don't need to be so rigid about that.
Yeah, just have a little.
I'm all for science.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Sometimes you got to throw stuff at kids. You know, in sports psychology, we call that simulations. And I'll give you one example before we finish up. Think about rugby. We'll talk about rugby for a second. I love rugby. Imagine if it's a sunny day and it's been a sunny day for 2 weeks straight for practice. But for this practice, I'm the head coach. I just said I'm going to bring a bucket of water and I'm going to dip the ball in water every single play. Why would I do that?
Just to adapt, yeah, adapt your athletes to the different demands.
Exactly, right?
Yeah.
So why can't we be creative as strength and conditioning coaches if we've been bragging for so long about how qualified we are and how much we know about science? Let's maybe put our head coach hat on and think about how we can simulate adverse conditions. Mm-hmm. Because we can't like stay away from that. Because I'll be honest, like doing alactic aerobic work all the time is damn comfortable for most kids.
Yeah.
And is that the only way we're developing them? Is that the only way we're training them?
Yeah,
I think we need to think a little bit further beyond that too.
I think expand that envelope a little bit as well, going from like the alactic power capacity into the lactic stuff, play around with that, try and put your skill coach's hat on, your sport coach's hat on, whatever it
totally,
is.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's what you have the best carryover to the field, to the court, whatever sport you're working in.
And if the kids are like, oh my God, that was the best workout ever, and dripping and lying in a puddle of their own sweat, and they feel like they've accomplished something, and even though you've trained the glycolytic pathway and it's medium intensity and everyone's going, oh my God, I can't believe you did that, maybe you've just built confidence.
Uh-huh. For sure.
Right? Like, so we do have to consider those things too.
That's actually that's a great point to stop on that. I don't want to overrun by too much. Just finally, Carmen, do you have any, I usually close out with like three questions or just for the guest. Any advice that you've got for young coaches coming into the field?
Yeah, for sure. You got to get a degree, right? So let's assume most of your readership are in school in a relevant field. I just don't think you can learn the stuff on weekend certifications. But having said that, be very, very critical of where you do get your continuing education knowledge. Red flags are usually around marketing campaigns, right? And it being more of a business model than an educational model. So educational models come with examinations. They come with learning outcomes, learning objectives. If something you're doing on the weekend doesn't have either one of those, or a proctor for your exam and an invigilator or credentialed people teaching, I wouldn't pay for it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's just too much good information out there that is really credible that you could spend money on. Be careful of buzzwords, things like, maybe I'll circle back to functional hypertrophy. Like if you look in a textbook, that term doesn't exist. So if someone's made it up, again, it speaks more to a business model than it does an educational model. And then get out there and coach. So, you know, if it's fine to spend money on books and courses, education is important, but it doesn't trump experience. I would prefer more of a 60-40, 40% education, 60% get in the trenches and start coaching before you know anything. Mm-hmm. And just fake it till you make it.
Sure.
All right. Like I started with my first team. I was 20 years old. It was the basketball team. I had read Super Training and that was it. And I had like a personal training certification. And then I just started learning. And then I remember a year later, I did a talk for the head coach at Gonzaga University. It was at a coaching conference. And I thought, oh my God, like the head coach of Gonzaga is listening to me talk about basketball performance. And he came up to me afterwards and he's like, wow, you really know basketball. Like, good job. And we kept in touch. And I thought, holy shit, I do. But I just like totally immersed myself in it at the time and tried to study as much as I could. And I say I spent more time going to practice and observing the sport than I did taking courses. And I'm seeing a shift now with young coaches. They're taking courses, reading, because some guru, sorry, that has like, you know, a 10,000 Instagram followers told them to read these books, and they're not out there interacting and talking to coaches and things like that. Like as much as I kind of said that a couple of things about coaches today, some of my best friends are coaches, sport coaches, and they are people who trust me to train their athletes. So coaches a lot of times just don't know what they don't know. They're not bad people. I'm really kind of sick of watching people eye roll coaches, because if you think about like how hard some of these people work, it's to be respected, and literally they don't know what they don't know. So you need to cultivate a relationship. Don't impose your knowledge on them until they ask. Now, if they're rude to you, and I have been treated very rudely by coaches behind my back, saying, well, why would she do 4 minutes off? And you know, that's not hard enough, and undermining me, then you can have boundaries and stick up for yourself and not put up with that. Right. Cause that's unprofessional.
For sure. For sure. And that's a great
point. So have your boundaries. You know, this is how I want to be treated, but we don't want to be like, oh my God, coaches are so stupid. They don't know what we know and blah, blah, blah. Well, they know what they know. You don't know what they know. Yeah, it's a total two-way street. So let's just like, hey, it's kind of cool. We're doing different jobs. Let's work together for the best interests of the athlete. And then we'll be athlete-centered, not egocentric.
For sure. Just my second to last question here. What books would you recommend? Any good
people books? Always ask me that. I don't know. No. Honestly, everyone needs an exercise phys textbook if you don't have one, and don't sell it, keep it, just because you will go back to it, believe it or not, just to kind of, even with stuff I talked about, you might be like, oh man, I forgot all that. You just read it again. No big deal.
Yeah.
Have it for reference. Keep it as a reference book. I wouldn't buy any books on program design, because if you understand physiology and motor skill acquisition, you can design a program. I really do like Mladen Jovanovic's work. I've read most of his book. I'm going to be working through his latest book in August. So I do tend to read his work. I quite like it. It's a bit high level though for kind of beginners. And I admit I love the Russian. So Verkhochansky, anything. But again, not easy to read because it's been originally written in Russian, translated to English. And Russian to English doesn't translate very well. So you'll read the same paragraph about 17 times. Don't worry. Have another beer. Try again. Okay? Because it's not easy to understand. But yeah, I like their stuff. Stay away from blogs, you guys. Know what people are saying, and you know, or a particular author who seems to be expert on every topic. It's like, that's not possible.
Yeah.
So we just need to be scrutinizing with what we're reading. I'm not saying don't read their stuff. I read poster stuff all the time. I think a lot of their circles are great. Mm-hmm. That's an example.
Yeah, for sure.
Right.
Then just finally, Karen, where can people find you if they've maybe got some questions on some of the topics we touched on here, or want to follow some of your stuff?
Yeah, sure. My website is coachbot.com, and the Wrestler's Edge, which is my product, it's a training program, is on fightcampconditioning.com, but you can also get to it through my website if people are interested. It's like a 500 page ebook on training wrestlers. Mm-hmm.
Perfect. That's good. So go and check out, for those that are listening, go and check out Carmen's website and get the book, and then you'll find out everything you need to know.
Everything. Just there you go. It's all there, people. You don't need to do any more work.
That's it.
Thanks, Chris.
Thanks, Cameron. I really appreciate you taking time out of your day. I've had a lot of fun and picked up quite a lot along the way as well. So thank you.
Oh, I'm glad. Good. Well, if anybody's confused, don't worry. You're not alone.
Thanks again.
Okay. Thank you.